Shalom Aleichem, sweetest friends. We are continuing our previous discussion about the methodology and mechanics of Psak. Again, based on an article by Hagar of Black Shlita. Eloel Dibre Elohim Chaim is a halachic axiom that pertains to the transcendental world of truth. Torah Kadmah L'Briyos Shel Olam Medrash Rabbah Bereishis Chesed Beis. Torah precedes and hence transcends the created universe. In the created universe, you can't have two contradictory rules. You can't apply Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel at the same time. If they have rules, if Beis Shammai has rules they follow and Beis Hillel has rules they follow, you can't follow both rules. It would be a contradiction. So there are a number of canons or rules that serve to adjudicate such conflicts. When you have conflicts in halacha, what are they? Many, if not most, are well known. Sefik d'oraisa l'chumra, sefik d'rabbanan l'kula, follow rov. If there's a machlokas, you follow later poskim. Halacha k'divrei evel b'avelos, and many, many more. Those canons sound quite simple. It might seem that halachic decision-making is a process of mechanical application of broad universal rules to particular questions. However, the rules of decision-making are not as straightforward as they might appear to be. Rechana Wasserman is reported to have made a remarkable observation. He pointed to two fundamental principles of halacha. One says that we follow the rov. However, there is a question with regard to the ambit of that principle. Suppose that the majority is composed of qualified scholars, whereas the minority is composed of extremely bright and sharp people. They are of highly superior intellect and clearly more erudite and more proficient than those of the majority. What happens if the majority, composed of qualified but relatively unexceptionable scholars, are of one opinion, but the people who are mechadid itfei, who are sharper and more erudite, are the minority? The Gemara Yivamis Yidalet Amal Aleph records a controversy with regard to whether the halacha is according to the majority as opposed to the more erudite minority, or whether the halacha is in accordance with the sharper, more incisive scholars, even though they constitute the minority. The protagonist remembers of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel said that while the halacha is always in accordance with the majority, while Beis Shammai ruled that the halacha is in accordance with the position of the Mechad Ditfei, even if they are not the majority. It happens to be the case that Beis Shammai were mechadidi tefei, sharper, brighter, and possessed of intellects keener than the members of Beis Hillel, while Beis Hillel were more numerous. Was it self-interest that motivated Beis Shammai to prefer mechadidi tefei over the rov? Chas v'shalom. They overcame their feelings of bias and they said what they thought was correct. Rav Elchanan points to a paradox that might readily have arisen. There is a separate, independent rule of decision-making. The Gemara says that we have a baskol, that Beis Sham Beis Hillel, Lachak Beis Hillel. So on one hand, we say that the Lachak is like Beis Hillel. On the other hand, we follow the rov, even if it's Mechadet Yitfei, because that's what Beis Hillel says. Let's say the position espoused by Beis Hillel and Beis Sham are reversed with regard to a machlokas between a rov and a miut. That is Mechadid Itfei, and the result would have been a paradox. The classic model of that paradox is, all Cretans are liars. I am a Cretan, therefore I am a liar. But if I am a liar, then I must be lying when I say all Cretans are liars. If so, all Cretans are liars is not a lie. It must follow, then, that all Cretans are liars. If so, I do not lie in saying all Cretans are liars. But if I am a liar, then and so on ad infinitum. Rav Chana doesn't allude to that paradox, but the formal nature of the two paradoxes are one and the same. Rabbi Sillel to have declared that the halacha is in accordance with the Mechad Ditfei, and if the Mechad Ditfei happened to have been Beis Shammai, it would have been tantamount to Beis Hillel saying that the halacha is in accordance with Beis Shammai. But in that hypothetical universe, Beis Shammai would have announced that the halacha is in accordance with the Rav, Beis Hillel. But Beis Hillel would have concomitantly declared the halacha to be in accordance with the Mechad Ditfei. Beis Shammai. And then Beis Shammai would say the halacha is like Beis Hillel, because they're the Rav. The Rav is going to say that the halacha is like the Mechad Ditfei, like Beis Shammai. And so we go round and round without end. Rav Elchanan adds that the determination, that the principle, that the halacha is according to Beis Hillel, and that Beis Hillel were also the ones who said that halacha is according to Rav, is not a mere coincidence. Rav Elchanan regarded the alignment of the parties in that controversy as nothing less than a nace. One need not necessarily term the fortuitous alignment of the opinions of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel as miraculous. It would seem sufficient to categorize them as the product of divine inspiration. Had the positions been reversed, would have been confronted with an irresolvable paradox. The divine lawgiver would not allow that to happen. He gave a certain canon of halachic decision making, and they must be serviceable, else they are purposeless. That is simply another way of saying that halachic decision making principles are also divinely ordained. They too are integral to the corpus of divine law. I'd be so bold as to say that these categories of psak halacha are the halachic analog of the Kantian categories, which according to Kant are imposed by human reason upon the empirical universe. Kant's thesis was that concepts such as causality are not extrapolated from our observance of the universe. Rather, the opposite is true. We look at the universe and we understand it according to the categories of human reason that are brought to bear upon our perceptions. The Kantian categories are not derived from observation, but are imposed by reason upon observation. The process could not have been different. Similarly, reason demands that halacha be applied by means of established canons, such as Kantian epistemology required that our understanding of the empirical universe be regulated by means of categories. We look at the corpus of halacha and we derive the psak halacha not simply from the substantive corpus itself, but, when not explicitly formulated within the corpus, from the vantage point of the categories that we impose upon the raw material of halacha. Formulation of these canons is also part of the halachic tradition, which is simply another way of saying that those canons are divine in their inception. The divine role in the decision-making process is explicitly acknowledged in a number of sources. Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, in his monograph Kimli, incorporated in the Urim V'Tumim, declares that no one can plead Kimli against an opinion, meaning that I want to follow a certain opinion. You can't say that against an opinion definitively accepted by both the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. As if the authors of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah are in agreement, one can point to another contradictory authority and claim, Hamotzi mechaveru v'raya. Because the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah say that it belongs to the other person. You can't point to a contradictory authority and say, Hamotzi mechaveru v'raya. An opinion rejected by these two authorities is utterly disregarded. It is as if it were non-existent. Why is that so? What is the difference whether an opinion was explicitly rejected by the Shulchan Aruch or Ramah, or whether it is otherwise categorized as an individual marginal opinion? Kimli is a principle that serves to confirm possession on the part of the defendant, despite the weight of legal authority in support of the plaintiff. The defendant pleads reliance upon a non-normative opinion. The burden of proving the cited authority to be incorrect falls upon the plaintiff and can never be met. The relied upon opinion is also Torah and hence must also be correct in the transcendental world of truth. In that realm, the opinion of an early day authority who disagrees with the author of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah is just as valid as the jointly held opinion of those scholars. If Eilu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, why can the defendant not plead Kimli against the jointly held view of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah? There is no Eilu Ve'elu in terms of adjudication between conflicting opinions for purposes of application in the terrestrial world simply because halacha requires at least a modicum of universal normative application. But that does not explain why the jointly held views of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, when they are in agreement, are accorded preference over other authorities. The Tumim's answer is that this is the case because Ruach HaKodesh Hofia B'Beis Midrashim, divine providence guided the Jewish community in their acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah as the definitive arbiters of Halacha. Not only is the corpus of theoretical Halacha divine in nature, but also the Mesorah of Halacha decision-making is also controlled by divine providence. Accordingly, if world Jewry accepted the jointly held opinion of Shulchan Aruch and Ramah as dispositive, it is because such was the divine will. Since such is the divine will, no litigant has the capacity to claim that any doubt remains regarding normative adjudication of the halacha. Tumim's explanation certainly stands for the proposition that Elu Ve'elu does not apply with regard to simply picking and choosing between various authorities. A more recent source is the Hakadama of the Igros Moshe. If Moshe was very unassuming in nature, nevertheless, he writes in effect that he is the authoritative posek because the master of the universe charged him with being a posek. He acknowledges his role as a posek to have been ordained by providence. R. Feinstein was not engaged in self-praise. He was, in all humility, stating his role as a simple matter. A fact, R. Feinstein asserted that some rabbinic scholars become recognized as poskim because the master of the universe guides people to such acceptance. The Mesorah of Halacha is determined by providence. In case of disagreement, canons of halachic decision-making are to be applied in adjudicating between conflicting opinions. The first question to be resolved is, who is a posek? Whose opinion is a credible expression of Elu Ve'elu? It is only with regard to disagreement between bona fide poskim that principles of roiv, sfeika d'oraisa, sfeika d'rabbanan apply. An eighth grader's answer to a question on a test does not rise to that level. The opinion of a novice is not placed on a scale together with those of mature poskim. As noted, Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, Zichrono Levracha, is quoted as saying that the Meiri is a mere curiosity. This is quoted by his Talmud, Rabbi Reichman. Interestingly enough, listen to this source. The Commentator newspaper, that's the YU student newspaper, on November 5th, 2006, on page 21. See also the book, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha, which is published in Yerushalayim 9 years ago on page 52, note 47. Meiri is widely quoted with regard to a small number of idiosyncratic positions attributed to him. None of those positions is particularly relevant to the present discussion. In none of those instances would Meiri's opinion affect halakhic decision-making in any way. But maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, his opinion about Goyim, his famous opinion about everything we said is about the old time of the Avodah Zarah, but today they're all Amos HaGeduros B'dasos, that the nations are menches, so many of the halachas don't apply. In any event, the import of Rabbi Soloveitchik's observation is far more profound. To describe Meiri as a mere curiosity doesn't mean that a Rosh Yeshiva will not consult a Meiri in the course of preparing a Shir. If the Rosh Yeshiva has a novel insight that can be substantiated by citing the Meiri, he will certainly quote the Meiri with alacrity and joy. At the same time, the point to be demonstrated depends solely on the Meiri, and if the Meiri's statement is contradicted by other early day authorities, the rabbinic scholar relies on Meiri alone, is skating on perilously thin ice. It goes without saying that the Meiri was a respected authority, but Soloveitchik meant only that the works of the Meiri are not part of the received Mesoras HaPsak. Applied halachic decision-making is also subject to Mesorah. Meiri is not part of that tradition. Although the reason why Meiri is not part of the Mesorah is not germane to the discussion, the reason is not difficult to discern. The Chazon Ish and others have recognized that all newly discovered manuscripts are suspect because we are ignorant of the provenance of those manuscripts. We have no assurance that tampering did not occur. We do not know whether Meiri himself was the author of those works, or whether one or another of his disciples compiled the manuscripts. A student of Meiri is not necessarily entitled to the same degree of deference that would be accorded to the master. Chronologically anomalous as it may seem, there are Achroinim who thrived in the period of the Rishonim. One should not assume that the distinction between Rishonim and Achroinim is merely one of chronology. The distinction lies in scholarship and erudition rather than in an accident of history. It is not to be assumed that every scholar who flourished in the historical period of the Rishonim is to be accorded deference due to Rishonim. Moreover, with regard to at least some of the matters for which Meiri is widely quoted, he is probably being misquoted either because the text is corrupt, or because of influence of the censor, or because Meiri was misled purposely or otherwise with regard to fundamental Christian dogma. See the aforementioned book, the Rabbi Black's The Philosophical Quest, on page 40 until page 52, and this can be purchased on Amazon and elsewhere. Furthermore, even were those statements to be authenticated as genuinely reflecting Meiri's acceptance of the underlying hypotheses, they would nevertheless constitute no more than a mere curiosity, an isolated opinion from a single early day authority, contradicted by a plethora of authoritative decisors, is certainly of intellectual value, but is equally certain that such an opinion is outside the mesira of halachic decision making. It seems that it was the latter point that Rav Soloveitchik meant to emphasize. Everything is dependent on mazel, even the Sefer Torah and the Aron, the Zohar says in Vayikra. Halachic decision making is guided by hashgacha. Rabbinic scholars did not have the access to the bulk of Meiri's writing until they were discovered in the Cairo Geniza. This is not an accident of history. The master of the universe is sought to it. That material later found in the repository would not be placed upon the scales of Psak Halacha in the age in which conflicting positions were weighed and precedents established. The Meseres HaHalacha, or tradition of halachic decision-making, is an ongoing process. Apart from the historical distinction between the Lishonim and the Achronim, there is a principle that is a bit more vague and a bit more amorphous, i.e. the doctrine of stare decisis, or precedent, for those who don't know Latin, within the period of the Achronim. Precedent in and of itself is little more than legal inertia, i.e. the status quo should not be disturbed, other than for good reason. In addition, the precedent has already been implemented, and in that sense has already entered and become part of the Mesila. But then how does one act when contradictory traditions have been espoused by earlier decisors? How does a jurist decide which precedent is to be regarded as controlling and which is to be relegated to the dustbin of legal history? The most obvious resolution of that question would be the invocation of a majoritarian principle. Roiv is a halachic construct. This derived from rabbinic exegesis of the verse Achrei Rabim Lahatois in Shmos 23:2. Two halachic rules are derived from that passage. The first is the principle of bittul, nullification. The halachic identity of a prohibited substance is submerged and nullified when it becomes part of a larger mixture. The second principle is the rule that when there exist two sets, one composed of many members and one composed of fewer members, an entity that strays from its original set and whose identity is unknown and is regarded as having been a member of the major set and hence retains the status of its original set. The principle of Rov applies in adjudication of conflicting claims or in determination of particular rules to be adopted by virtue of the invocation of and amalgam of both principles of Rov. The ruling is regarded as having emerged from the major set of scholars. At the same time, when the majority of the Beis Din disagree, the decision is not simply that of the majority. It represents a decision of the full complement of the Beis Din. The majority are not competent to issue a ruling without the participation of the dissenting minority. Members of the minority are able to participate in the judgment because their identity is submerged within the identity of the majority. This is the famous Reb Chaim HaLevi in the Chidushi HaGrach, the HaGriz al HaShas, page 226-228, widely quoted. However, Roiv, as an ironclad rule of adjudication, applies to resolution of controversy only when scholars assemble, deliberate, and issue a collective opinion. In that context, Roiv determines the position of the group as collective, the view that those in the minority is submerged in and nullified by the view of the majority. Thus, the position of the group as a collective is determined by the majority of its members. That notion finds eloquent expression in a rule applicable in judicial decisions that prohibits identifying the members of the minority. The members of the minority count as part of the complement of judges required to hear the case. Accordingly, even in dissent, they are necessarily for the issuance of a judgment. However, in weighing precedents, there is no confrontation or interaction between members of the majority and members of the minority. Hence, There is no collective body to which a unitary opinion can be assigned. Although in such situations the principle of majority rule does not apply in the strict sense of the term, determinations are nevertheless made in accordance with what might be termed weighted precedent. To paraphrase George Orwell, equal faith and credit must be assigned to the opinion of all scholars, but some scholars are more equal than others. The opinion of every qualified scholar must be considered, but the opinion of some will weigh more heavily than the opinion of others. The ultimate determination will depend upon assigning appropriate weight to the opinion of each individual and then balancing the collective weight of each side one against the other. Accordingly, adjudicating between conflicting authorities is essentially a determination of how much weight to assign to any given halachic decisor. By way of analogy, assume that a Chinese patient presents with a malignancy. 10 barefoot doctors, quote unquote, prescribe a macrobiotic diet, and one board-certified oncologist advises chemo. A discerning patient will find no difficulty in determining which regimen to follow. Folk medicine should not be disparaged necessarily, but scientific expertise is crucial in determining proper medical treatment. The weight of numbers is irrelevant when countered by medical expertise. If Rabbi Akiva Eiger issued a ruling that is contradicted by a number of published responses authored by individuals of significantly less stature, there is scant question that majority rule does not apply. When presented with conflicting opinions expressed by halachic decisors, part of the process of halachic decision making is to determine how much weight to assign to any given authority in reaching a decision. Eilei Adibur Elokim Chaim is certainly operative within the world of transcendental truth, but the world of transcendental truth is the world of theoretical halacha. In the realm of applied halacha, Eilei Adibur Elokim Chaim is not relevant to adjudication between conflicting opinions. But in weighing the opinions of recognized poskim, how does one assign relative weight to diverse decisors in determining which opinions shall serve as precedent? To a certain extent, authoritativeness is established by reputation and acceptance on part of the other decisors. Medicine again serves as an apt analogy. Physicians achieve prominence as outstanding practitioners on the basis of acknowledgement as such by their peers. Fellow physicians are certainly in the best position to evaluate the expertise of members of their profession. Such evaluation is part of the art of medicine. Similar evaluation is part of the art of halachic decision-making. This is not to deny that, not infrequently, disagreement arises in evaluating the relative weight to be given to the opinion of one authority over the other, but just as often and probably more often, a consensus develops as time passes, and certainly over a period of generations, the authoritativeness of certain decisors and of certain decisions become part of Mesoras HaHalacha. That, too, is in no small part by operation of providence. There is also a clear difference between a firmly held opinion formulated sua sponte by an authoritative psak and a decision based upon announced opinions of other decisors. A qualified posek proficient in shas and poskim who has analyzed an issue, applied the relevant sources, and arrived at a reasoned conclusion is not bound by canons such as halacha kedivrei hamekel va'avel, i.e. in laws and matters of mourning, the halacha is like the permissive view, suffik deraisa l'chumra, Savik Rabbanan Makula. A qualified scholar who is confident that he has not overlooked relevant sources and has reached a firmly held conclusion is duty-bound to rule in accordance with his own opinion. Again, see the introduction of the Ivas Moshe. Should a posek demur because he's afraid that he has arrived at an erroneous conclusion? In response, one can only shrug one's shoulders and say, what do you mean by saying that he's wrong? He can't be wrong. It's axiomatic that his conclusion is correct. Whatever decision the Talmud Vatik, the proficient student, reaches, was revealed to Moshe Har Sinai, like we see in the Medrash Rabban Vayikra 22.1, also in the Yerushalmi. The reticence of a qualified posek is born of what we could term judicial humility. But there is but a thin line separating justified reticence and unjustified humility. The scholar fears that he has not reached the status of Talmud Shegiyah L'Hara, i.e. that he's not fully competent, that he is but an insufficiently qualified student. That too is a judgment call, but a judgment call that's made by peers. How should a posek who has less than full confidence in his halachic prowess conduct himself? It seems that such an individual may recuse himself if he so chooses. He may refer the interlocutor to someone whom he believes to be a more consummate scholar, a greater Talmud Chacham. That course of action constitutes recusal and would be appropriate under the circumstances. However, it would seem that he would not have the right to respond by saying, such and such a scholar has a different opinion. You should accept that scholar's ruling rather than follow my opinion. That would be intellectually inconsistent and would constitute a dereliction of duty. The Gemara in Chulin, Tzadi Tes Amud Beis, discusses whether the sciatic sinew of the Gid HaNasha has tam, has taste, such that when transferred to other foodstuffs, it renders those foodstuffs impermissible. Rav Ami said that food cooked together with the Gid HaNasha is forbidden. On one occasion, when such food was brought before him, he directed the parties to Rav Yitzchak ben Chaluf, who was wont to rule permissively in accordance with Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, but Rav Ami did not agree. Clearly, Rav Ami felt constrained not to inform the parties that Rav Yitzchak ben Chaluf held a contradictory view and to counsel them to rely upon that permissive view, but instead referred them directly to Rav Yitzchak ben Chaluf. Rav Ami might recuse himself and send the parties elsewhere, but himself to counsel reliance upon Rav Yitzchak ben Chaluf would have been perversion of his own view, with Rashi, Rabbi Gershon. The foregoing is the case with regard to what we can term substantive psak, because it is only with regard to substantive psak that Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim is applicable, i.e. the decision is made by a person who has earned the right to an opinion, and his opinion is substantiated by analysis of sources together with application of his intellect. That is quite different from a situation of a person who does not have or is not entitled to have an independent opinion. Decisions rendered in such circumstances are entirely dissimilar. Again, a very simple parallel. There are numerous varieties of mushrooms, some poisonous, some non-poisonous. There are horticulturists who are trained to recognize which are poisonous and which are not. The horticulturist has no problem distinguishing between the various species. The ability to distinguish between them is an art, a science, or a bit of both. When buying mushrooms in the supermarket, the consumer applies upon the purveyor to ascertain that its wares pose no danger. But as a non-expert, I would not take a basket and go foraging for mushrooms in the forest. I recognize that I am not proficient in Hilchos mushrooms. I am afraid that I may pick a poisonous mushroom. I know there are kosher mushrooms in the forest. There are non-kosher, quote-unquote, mushrooms in the forest. I'm still not going to stake my life upon an unreliable hunch with regard to which mushrooms are poisonous and which aren't. By the same token, if there are two people guiding me and one says the mushroom is poisonous, while the other says it is not poisonous, you may be certain that I will run from the mushroom as quickly as my feet will carry me. I am not at all fazed by a competent scholar who tells me that it is possible to construct a valid Eruv in the city of New York or in another large metropolitan area. If the person tells me he has mastered Shas and Poskim, is an expert in Hilchos Eruvin as well, and that he has resolved the underlying halachic issues in a manner different from the later Moshe Feinstein or virtually every other recognized Posek, fine. He has a right to do so because he's earned the right to an opinion. I become perplexed when a layman tells me I carry in my city on Shabbos because Rabbi Ploni, not the great, gone, genius Rabbi Ploni, said you may do so. Would the same individual be willing to rely upon a person who is not an expert in, quote-unquote, Hilchos mushrooms? If not, is he more concerned with regard to his body than his soul? In matters of psak halacha, can a prudent person rely upon an individual who is less than fully proficient? It is one thing for a person to resolve an issue on the basis of his own erudition, his own insight and expertise in Shas and Poskim. It's quite another to tell me that he's relying upon Rabbi X, and there are other experts who are equally competent, if not more so, who declare that the Eruv cannot be relied upon. What is the source of a license to accept less than competent halachic advice? This is but one example. More generally, a person does not have the right to rely upon a Das Yachid, even when expressed by an early Achron by invoking the principle of Eilel Divrei Elokim Chaim. In the world of transcendental halacha, what he said is true, but not in the world of practical halacha, where Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman once told a visitor, if you knew as many tshuvas as I do, you'd be a goy gamer. Rav Ruderman was a big bucky in tshuvas. What did he mean? The visitor was not a person of great spiritual probity. The visitor had embraced many diverse leniencies. He was a kula sweeper. He swept up kulas. He managed to adopt all sorts of kulas because he succeeded in finding the ones that he was seeking. Rav Ruderman accurately informed the visitor that if this person had known as many tshuvas as Rav Ruderman, he'd be a guy. He would end up finding so many kulas, he would look like a guy. So we'll conclude with what we started at the beginning. We mentioned something called prophylactic psak, which we said is halachic punting, avoiding paskening in the first place. In commercial and financial matters, there is an available option that serves to avoid a hard and fast application of pertinent halachic rules. Rabbinical courts uniformly urge litigants to accept arbitration rather than to insist upon a judgment strictly in accordance with the letter of the law. In part, that is because the rabbinical judges seek to avoid the responsibility of adjudicating between competing authorities. In matters of religious law, one can avoid acts which are even only possibly forbidden. That is tantamount to cutting off the problem at the pass, but there are times when it is impossible to avoid the issue. A Rosh Hashiva was once asked what one should do if one forgot to say Yalav Yavo and realizes his omission after concluding Hamachzir Shechinah Selitzion. The correct answer is a Machlekes Mishnah Berurah HaShulchan. So, Rosh Hashiva was being asked, what's the Hachoah? Do we follow Mishnah Berurah the Aruch HaShulchan? And the answer of the Rosh Hashiva is, Vos men ve'ton is good. Whatever you do is good. There's no Hachoah. Eilu ve'eilu. Even in the world of practical halacha. One can either go back to Ritzei, that's the Aruch HaShulchan, or say Yalav Yavu before Molden. You can't avoid this dilemma. You have to do one or the other. And we say Eilu Ve'eilu. There's no Hachra here. However, there are other situations where you can cover all the bases. All the bases. Like on Rosh Hashanah. We blow Tashrat Trua, Shvarim, Trua Tkia, Tashat, Tkia, Shvarim, Tkia, Tarat, Tkia, Trua Tkia. Why do we do so? Because the Torah says Yom Trua Yelachem. We don't know with certainty what a Trua is. So we do them all. And this way we avoid the problem. We try to be Yotzei all the days. Does preparing food in a microwave constitute cooking in halacha? Assuming any other problem involved in setting the microwave oven or opening its door could be overcome by modifying the apparatus, is it possible to cook by means of microwaving on Shabbos? Does food already prepared in a microwave have the status of uncooked food and hence remain subject to biblical prohibition against conventional cooking on Shabbos? Can you cook in a microwave oven basar v'chala for a guy? Can a Jew eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew in a microwave? A lot of bishul questions by microwave. So what do? There are two possibilities. It's possible to apply the general canons of halachic decision making, including Safek Daraisa L'Chumra, Safek Darabanan L'Kula. Or one can avoid the question by not using a microwave in situations that give rise to such questions. The easy way is the cop-out, or better, a punt. Don't use the microwave oven for any purpose that may give rise to a matter of doubt that has not been resolved and leave the resolution for another day and another posse. Finally, one must be clear in distinguishing between the absence of a hachra and matters of chumrah. People seem to believe that in brisk, all matters of chumrah were practiced. It's not true. It's a misconception. Perus, the introduction to the Chiddushei Reb Chaim and Bava Metzia, published a number of years ago. As reported, Reb Chaim disparaged the Hasidim who adopted various chumras, for example, on Sukkos. They didn't drink water outside the sukkah. Hasidim certainly had reasons for not drinking water other than within a sukkah, but there is no early day authority who rules that it's forbidden to drink water on Sukkos outside a sukkah. Reb Chaim reportedly saw no reason to emulate that pietistic practice. Why? Simply because he had no interest in adopting chumras. See also the Sefer Nichocha Shel Torah on page 230. But at the same time, Brisk was notorious for not wanting to issue rulings regarding matters involving halachic disagreement and to engage in conduct that would require adjudicating between early day authorities. Brisk didn't want to do so because Brisk felt that we are not competent to resolve a controversy between early day authorities. Consequently, their psak was often prophylactic, obviate the problem by avoiding it. In the first place, it is almost axiomatic in a legal community that a good litigator is not an attorney who prevails in litigation. Rather, a good litigator is one who uses his legal skills in avoiding litigation. In our day, the primary task of a halachic decisor, particularly one who is less than fully competent, may be, well, not adjudication between conflicting views, but identifying or fashioning expedients in order to avoid the need for adjudication. Halacha is an intellectual discipline by its pursuit, but its pursuit is accompanied by awesome moral and religious responsibility. Halachic pronouncements should bear a Surgeon General's warning that they may be dangerous to the spiritual health and well-being. The onus of error is entirely analogous to that which in the realm of physical accompanies the granting of a good housekeeping seal of approval or the issuance of public warning of impending danger. An erroneous endorsement can easily lead to serious danger. An unwarranted interdiction can wreak havoc with human lives. More reports that upon entering the base of Medrash of Nechum ben Akana were to say at Fila, Shalayer v'davar atvarat kal adiv, lo kashv v'dvar alecha, shalom mei Torah tamei, lo tamei tohor, like we see in Brachas 28b. I don't want to say the impure is pure, pure impure. I don't want a mistake. Rav Nechum ben Akana well understood the awesome nature of every halachic determination and the need for divine assistance in avoiding error. The Tfila, recording the Gemara, is a poignant reminder for posterity that halachic matters must be regarded with at least the same seriousness that attends the mundane. In its most fundamental sense, Yerushimayim is the reflection of a conviction that halachic error or laxity is as dangerous to the soul as other forms of error may be to the body. In the absence of Yerushimayim, fulfillment of mitzvahs is in essence a matter of cultural expression. Folk practices may be valued, but they are unlikely to become all-consuming. Cultural inclination may dictate enthusiastic participation in ceremonies and rituals, but will hardly command concern with minutiae and details. Yerushimayim is the hallmark that serves to distinguish between cultural expression and religious observance. It is the factor that serves to separate those sectors of our community that recognize the centrality of halacha and its study from those that fail to accord halacha such primacy. For the latter, mitzvahs are a matter of taste and preference, and even of personal satisfaction. For the former, they are a matter of spiritual life and health. For the former, thirst for Torah knowledge is never quenched. For them, the study of Torah is the noblest of activities and most sublime of joys. Our sacred charge is to transmit to all members of our community the faith commitment of which genuine fidelity to halacha is born, and in doing so, has in fulfillment of the property of the prophecy, U'malaretz de'as Hashem, k'mayim liyam lechasim, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of Hashem, as the waters cover the sea, in the Sefer of Yeshaya, Perikot Aleph, Pasuk Tes. And this was just incredible. And B'siyata Dishmaya, we will hopefully talk about this more, because this is such a central issue. And B'lineder, hopefully we'll be zocher. Okay, thank you so much for listening. Shalom, shalom, sweetest friends.